Thank you very much, Mr. Weber. It's a pleasure to be here with everybody. Even though we're not together physically, we know that God will unify our spirits together, and we're grateful for his presence with us. Thanks to Mr. Beatty and to Mr. Howe for picking up on the services. It certainly is wonderful to have. Brethren, in the year 1945, as the war in the Pacific raged on, it became apparent to the U.S. military leadership that despite the continued march toward the Japanese home islands, fighting was becoming more intense, more ferocious, and it was clearly becoming more deadly. The severe casualties suffered at Okinawa and Iwo Jima demonstrated that the Japanese forces would continue to resist at any cost. The bitter fighting on these two islands led to U.S. casualties reaching horrifying numbers. In Okinawa, the casualty rate was 2-1 from American military to Japanese. In Iwo Jima, it was even worse at 1.25-1. There were over 100,000 U.S. casualties between these two battles. America had decided that the war would end only with the unconditional surrender of Imperial Japan. But the fierceness of the battles had become a test of wills between the two nations. Would the United States have the continued resolve to match the Japanese, who showed no signs of breaking, no signs of slowing down? The fear among military leadership was that the advancement to and the subsequent invasion of each island would lead to a string of Okinawas, but with with exponentially higher casualties, with resistance increasing at each stop, what would be the solution to this terrible problem? Now, the D-Day invasion into Europe was the biggest and most incredible amphibious assault in history. The tactics and the resources and the coordination required to pull off that single event was simply amazing, but it could not compare to the breadth and scope of what was ultimately designated as Operation Downfall. This was the U.S. plan to invade the Japanese homeland and force their unconditional surrender by any and all means necessary. It was to begin on November 1st, 1945. The U.S. military strategists put their best case scenario at an additional 18 months of brutal warfare with Imperial Japan before a victory could be achieved. That was the best case scenario. The U.S. was preparing for a minimum of 500,000 dead Americans, with as many as 1 million dying in combat, along with up to 4 million people being wounded on the American side. With that expectation, 500,000 Purple Heart medals were immediately commissioned and made, anticipating the carnage that would come. Now, the number estimated for U.S. casualties is truly a horrific number, but the expected Japanese losses were truly apocalyptic. In the best case, 5 to 10 million Japanese citizens and soldiers would be killed. In later years, it was discovered with notes and interviews that the Japanese military leaders had privately considered sacrificing up to 20 million Japanese civilians in defense of their country. And given the kamikaze attacks already seen in Okinawa and Iwo Jima, there's little doubt that this could have been implemented. The conclusion to World War II would certainly have been the fiercest, the most brutal, and the most horrendously destructive sequence of events that could have been imagined. How could any good nation, no matter the cause, willingly engage in something like this? Now, if none of this sounds familiar to you, it's because it didn't happen that way. When this plan was submitted to President Truman on July 2nd, 1945, it was one of two options that they were discussing. Now, fast forward 1 month to August 6th, 1945. Shigetsu Mitsu Tanaka was 5 years old. He was playing under a persimmon tree when he heard a huge thunderclap and saw the sky go completely white. All of the windows in his family home were blown out, and once the world stopped shaking and his eyesight and his hearing returned to him, all he could hear was moaning, and he was overwhelmed by the smell of burning flesh. In an instant, on a clear August day, over 70,000 people in the city of Hiroshima were dead. 75% of its buildings were completely demolished. In the following days, thousands more would die of the after effects of radiation and the lack of medical care. At first, the Japanese did not know what happened. The broadcast station at Hiroshima had gone off air. They then realized that the telephone and the telegraph line stopped working. They started getting reports from nearby stations of confusing talk about a terrible explosion. The Japanese Army General Staff dispatched a staff officer to fly to Hiroshima to then land, survey the damage, and return to Tokyo with information. At the time, it was felt that nothing serious had happened and that an explosion was just a rumor. After flying for 3 hours, while still 100 miles away, the officer and his pilot saw a great cloud of smoke that was resulting from the bomb, 100 miles away. They eventually reached the remains of Hiroshima, where they circled the desolate city to survey the damage before returning to Tokyo to report that it was completely destroyed. Hours later, President Truman announced the strike by a new atomic type of bomb, and the world, it changed forever. On August 9th, with Japan still holding on to some resistance, a plutonium device with even greater explosive power was dropped on the city of Nagasaki. The desolation wrought by the two blasts was truly unimaginable. Estimated mortalities ranged between 110,000 to 210,000 people. Utterly shaken by the display, Japan surrendered unconditionally in the following days. Now, it didn't take an additional 18 months of brutal conventional warfare with millions of deaths because Operation Downfall never had to take place. President Truman instead chose the second option, which was to deploy the most destructive and horrific weapon ever created. Up to that point, there was seemingly nothing that could be done to break the fighting spirit of Imperial Japan. Their soldiers and citizens would fight to the bitter end in every conflict. Earlier in the war, the firebombing of Tokyo actually killed more people than the atomic explosions did at the end of the war. But the firebombing of Tokyo seemed to have no effect on the resolve of Japan. As Truman's Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, later pointed out, the atomic bomb was more than a weapon of terrible destruction. It was a psychological weapon. He said it was not one atomic bomb or two which brought surrender, but it was the experience of what an atomic bomb will actually do to a community, plus the dread of many, many more that was effective. Now, President Truman at the time, he saw this as a simple decision. He had already extended the offer to surrender to Japan and they flat out refused it. And the way that he saw it is you can save countless millions by sacrificing tens of thousands. He was quoted as saying that he lost no sleep that night because he saw that there was no other way. Now, as of this week, it has been 75 years since these events took place. The world that we live in today was created by this decision, and its legacy is still all around us. To this day, there are debates about, was this the right decision to make? Were there other alternatives? Why did America unleash this destruction on an innocent civilian population? These are all valid questions, and people will continue to debate them and argue their merits. The question that I want to ask you today, as we and the rest of the world will take a time to reflect on what happened 75 years ago, how should we view this series of events as a Christian? We're certainly Americans as we listen to this. Our nation was involved in that. Perhaps some of us were even alive at the time when this happened. But how do we view it as a Christian, and how should we view it? I have a number of takeaways, so let me go through them. First of all, this leaves a truly complicated legacy. Now, from the human perspective, there's no question to me that Truman did what can be considered the merciful option. Countless lives between then and now were saved, exponentially more than those that were lost at the time. But it still stands out as the most horrific single moment in the history of warfare, where tens of thousands of innocent people died in the blink of an eye, and thousands more died afterwards from radiation burns or the fallout of the explosion. Now, with that complicated legacy, we ask the question, well, why did this happen? There's another saying that Jesus told us in Matthew 26, verse 52. I'm not going to turn there. We know it pretty well. But Matthew 26, 52, Jesus told Peter that those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And that was true for the Japanese in this case. They brought the war to our shore. They brought the war to many other shores. The things that they did during the war themselves were truly horrific. And so they certainly were not just an unassuming nation that was brutally attacked. they started a war, and the way they fought the war was terrible. So it certainly is true with the saying that if you live a life by the sword, you live a life that way, there's almost a natural consequence that takes place, because other people who have swords will likely use them against you as well. So that's certainly a true saying. It's also true for us, though. We are willing to engage in military conflict around the world. We also carry a very large sword, and we had the biggest one at that time. And so it's something that we should also be cautious of as a nation, because those who live by the sword, as Jesus said, ultimately may die by the sword as well. Another thought, with the discovery of nuclear fission in 1937, it was only a matter of time before nuclear weapons would be created. If America hadn't gotten the bomb first, I think a much truer horror would have resulted, and the world would have been plunged into darkness. Yes, the bomb being dropped set the stage for a nuclear standoff with the Russians and the rest of the world that lasted decades. The world was brought certainly to the brink of annihilation, but it was that threat of nuclear war itself and that memory of what happened in Japan that prevented it from happening and has kept the peaceful world order that we experience today more or less in place for the last 75 years. That peace has allowed for the church to meet peacefully, to assemble in freedom, to have each one of us go about our lives without oppression or attack. So we've all benefited from that for sure. And it seems likely to me that God has stayed the event of nuclear war because he does not yet consider it time to allow it. Another thought is, this is a reason that a faithful Christian could never be president. How could you give an order to take the life, let alone 200,000 lives at a single stroke of a pen? And what would Jesus say about that if you were a Christian in that position? Well, I think he would say, follow me, because regardless of the situation you're in and the seemingly impossible choices that you face, the choice to follow Christ, regardless of the consequence, is the only way to save your life. He doesn't ask us to make decisions that involve the life and death of others. He wants us to focus on him alone and what he requires of us. And the wrong thing done for the right reason is still wrong. While Truman saw this only in human terms, it is clear that God hates war and does not condone the death of the innocent. Please turn to Jeremiah 22 and verse 3. In Jeremiah 22 and verse 3, it says, "Thus says the Lord, execute judgment and righteousness and deliver the plundered out of the hand of the oppressor. Do no wrong and do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, or the widow, nor shed innocent blood in this place." After the blast took place, there were over 2,000 surviving children who were immediately made orphans, many having to wander and live off the streets alone for months. So even though you could make the argument that it was the merciful action and the right thing to do at the time, it was still wrong because of what it meant, what you had to do. And I think that's what God would say in that case. And another thought is, we've all heard the term, what would Jesus do? WWJD, right? It's a good question in every case to stop and ask, but I think it misses the focus a little bit. How about we ask, how does he instruct us to live? Turn to Luke chapter 6. Go to Luke chapter 6. You can find it here. Go to Luke chapter 6, and we'll go to verse 27. It says, Jesus says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who spitefully use you." He tells us to love our enemies. He tells us to love our brother, to love our neighbor. And I think this is why a Christian, by definition, has to be a pacifist, because how can you love your neighbor when you are fighting him to the death? We are all called to be lights in a dark world, and our refusal to engage in violence is part of what makes that light shine. We let God do the fighting for us, and he will fight when Christ returns. You may ask, what does that fight look like? Well, those, we are told in a prophecy, who make war with the Lamb upon his return will have their skin melt from their body. Perhaps that's reminiscent of the atomic explosions that we referenced earlier. And a final thought I take away from this is, if there was a single indicator for what could be considered the beginning of the end times, I submit to you that it was this moment when humanity finally gained the capability to end all life on Earth. In many ways, the world is still living in the shock of that moment. The destructive power that we saw then has halted advanced militaries, and in a way, it's removed the taste for real war between superpowers, You certainly saw that in the Cold War that lasted decades. But a time will come when the world overcomes that initial shock and madmen take us into a nuclear war that will set us on the course to end all life as we know it. Our calling is not to be a part of that world, but to come out of it. We don't need to debate whether this military action is good or this one is bad. Is this one justified or not? We know that any action in violation of God's law is wrong. We have clear definitions of what sin is and how we should conduct ourselves. We know that we must show love to all, be good to those who would hurt us, and keep our eyes focused ahead to the kingdom of God, where Jesus will return and his unquestioned rule will ultimately remove the scourge of war that humanity lives in now. And that really is our only hope. And so as the world takes notice and reflects on the events of 75 years ago, let us recognize it for what it was, a continuation of the terrors that men do to each other, and a great reminder that there is a better life that will come and a better way to live. And it is one that each of us need to be living already today with all of our hearts. Have a happy Sabbath, brethren.